Well, good morning. It's tough shoes to follow to have to, even follow Rattan in a recorded presentation. That's kind of an awkward position to be in, but I'll do my best. Let's see here. There we go. And he really set me up nicely. He's done a really nice job, and this whole idea of protecting the soil, making sure that we maintain that invaluable resource is just absolutely critical. How do we protect this soil? How do we maintain this natural resource? Is it even possible to have any bioenergy production and maintain that soil? Are they completely juxtaposed, or are there some strategies that, rather than this indiscriminate harvest, that we can maybe find at least some silver bullets? I agree that, crop residues are not going to be the answer. I agree with that philosophy 100%. We cannot indiscriminately go out there and harvest it. And like Rattan, I just cringe when I see that ad with calling my crop residues waste. It just drives me crazy. Whoops. So a working hypothesis then, and the answer to this may be that no, we can't do this, but maybe we can in some places with some forethought. Can crop residues, and because corn residue is a large player, at least in the Midwest of the United States and across the United States in many cases, simply based on the number of acres and the overall production, that it may be one of the sources that we can take a look at. And can we do this in a sustainable manner? And the hypothesis, the null hypothesis is yes. Well, and I like to define what sustainable is, because depending upon the group you're talking to, you may have very divergent understandings of what this definition is. And the definition that this is stole from the Renewable Energy Assessment Project that I'm part of, a large ARS project, is that we're going to ensure that the soil and other resources can continue to meet the demands, that they're going to be able to continue to feed us, provide the fuel, the fiber, and whatever else we need from them. Not for 10 years, not for 100 years, but indefinitely, so that we are borrowing and using these resources wisely because they belong to our children, our grandchildren. That it looks at both near and long-term effects, that we're not just looking at what's going on today, but looking at what the economic trade-offs may be. And that we have to maintain the long-term productivity. Now, there's a whole suite of feedstocks, and Rattan went through a long list of those. I'm going to focus mostly on the agronomic type of things. We have the straws, the corn stover or wheat straws or the small grain straws. There's also a variety of perennial crops that are likely to be growing. This would be a mixed species. This is blue stem, we have switchgrass over here, and then we have a variety of oilseed type crops. So we have a diversity of crops that may be grown within a similar landscape or different parts of a landscape on the same farm or at least in the same watershed. There are some emerging oilseed crops. If any of you heard Dr. Russ Gesch talk yesterday, he spoke at length on some of these. A colleague of mine at Morse who's really looking at some of these unique oilseed crops that may be used for biodiesel, but also for industrial or things like aviation fuel, because they have some very unique properties. And they would fit into this mix as well. And a little later in my talk, I'll point out how they might actually fit in and give us some strategies to help make things work a little more sustainably. One of the things that's been well established in the literature is the impact of modern agriculture's had on soil carbon reserves. At some point in time, intensive agriculture began. And there's, in essence, over time, a substantial loss in soil carbon. Some of that may be due just to enhanced decomposition. We went from being in perennial systems with perennial roots and huge amounts of inputs, whether it was the prairies or the forests that were cut down and disturbed. A lot of carbon was lost. Substantial amounts of carbon were driven out of those systems. Some of these systems have begun to accrue. Some of them have stabilized, depending upon the management and the yields that's on them. But the concern is, and you can stick in your favorite residue, this one happened to have been set up for stover, but you could put in your favorite residue and you start removing. If there isn't other mitigating practices, the concern is that we're going to continue to drive down the organic matter in those soils and further degrade them. And then you're eventually shooting yourself in the foot. Some of these soils are highly buffered, that they will survive and continue to be, at least in the short term, productive. But sooner or later, you will drive them to the point that you will hit the tipping point and they'll no longer be as productive, and even with inputs. Erosion is a concern. You know, what are those first line of defense on that soil? Well, it's what it's ever covering it. As soon as you start to uncover it, you're at risk for whether it's wind or water. And I put this collage together. We have the ode to the pole where the tillage has driven it off. These wonderful balding spots, kind of like the growing bald spot on middle-aged man, you know, they just keep getting bigger. And a lot of that is directly due to tillage erosion. Gravity works. If you go across, and it doesn't matter if you're going uphill or downhill, tillage lifts the soil particles, and they're going to move downhill. And then you get these wonderful, you know, little balding spots up there. And this is subsoil that starts being exposed, which is not as productive. And you can see how it's starting to shed down. You start burying the topsoil, and you get inverted topsoils after a time, and then increase your variability in yield and makes management problems. I have a colleague that's also looking at how we can restore these and moving these materials from the bottom back up to the top. That's Sharon Papiernik, and she's doing a wonderful job there, but I'll let her talk about those results. You know, you get the tillage going on, and you see this huge plume of dust coming behind. You know, on wind erosion, this is a pile of soil, not snow against this car. And this is Morse, Minnesota, where when it's exposed, there's a tilled field here, and you get this beautiful snow, or mixed with soil, otherwise known as snert. And this is, you know, can be kind of interesting to look at, but very damaging because a lot of soil's moved away. And then, of course, wind erosion and water erosion, where you have the soil being displaced. And what soil is displaced? The topsoil that's most rich in soil carbon. And any ag chemicals, fertilizers, pesticides, whatever is in there, is now moving away and into the waterways or ditches, where instead of being a benefit, it's now a liability. Erosion, we've seen a similar slide that Rattan presented. And basically, we have, as residue is increased, you're going to are removed. This is the extent of residue harvest. The more you harvest, the risk of water moving and taking the soil with it increases geometrically. These are classic curves. It varies amongst the types of soils, but in essence, as you remove stover, as you remove residue, you expose that topsoil, it will erode. And this is because these are geometric, here's the 2.5 megagrams per hectare per year, the kind of classic soil limitation. It comes from the point these start changing, from the asymptote. Soil aggregation is also dependent on having these biomasses there. And the upshot, this is a collection of data from the literature, but removing biomass increases the number of wind erodible aggregates. So if you're removing it, the aggregate size is reducing, so now it can blow away. That's kind of the upshot of this busy slide. As was also alluded to by Rattan, that nutrients are going to be removed. This is from a literature review, and then from a colleague of mine on this is grasses that are growing for seed in the Pacific Northwest. But you're going to be removing nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and all the long list of the micronutrients, all of them. I just collected these. But this is above and beyond what's removed in the grain. One of the concerns there is if you're removing more of the nutrients, you may have to replace those with additional fertilizer. This is the nitrous oxide level that was put out a few years ago. And right through the Corn Belt, where we put on a lot of nitrogen for growing corn, no surprise that the levels of nitrous oxide are increased. So if we're, okay, now we're doing a double whammy, we're removing some of the soil carbon. So we're driving that down, putting CO2 in the atmosphere, and if we're releasing more nitrous oxide, now we're setting ourselves up, instead of mitigating for global climate change, we're exacerbating it. And that's not where we want to go with this. So we need to make sure that we're not inducing land use change that takes things from a situation where they're in perennials and put it into intensive agriculture, or going from CRP back to row crops. There are ways that you can manage CRP, perhaps for harvesting, without going to row crops, without losing the benefits of the accrued carbon. Intensifying of tillage, it leaves that soil susceptible to erosion, can accelerate decomposition, and declining fertility. So we have a variety of risks that we have to contend with. This is a recent publication that came out, and really looking at this competing ideas. We have economic drivers that really are trying to force what we would do with residue harvest, that it has to make logistic sense. If it's too small of an amount, it doesn't make sense. And we want to be able to have contracts, and so we want to push up ways. This arrow is pushing the amount that you're harvesting. When you factor in the things that we have to consider to make sure that we're protecting our resource, like soil carbon or erosion or the nutrients and the microclimate effects, that pushes down the viable amount that you could harvest. From an energy standpoint, from the industry standpoint, and trying to come to some sort of grips on how we can come up with a happy medium, what are some things that we might be able to do that will compensate? If we're going to take some percent of the stover, what might we do to compensate? Can we change our agronomic strategies so that we can have at least a silver bullet out of this? Are we looking at changing our cropping system and being careful how we manage that landscape and making sure we're recognizing these ecosystem services? Well, this is a $6,400 question. What is that minimum amount that we need to be making to go back in? If we want to find some kind of balance, we don't want to cause further degradation. We would like to maintain or improve those soils. Well, first off, where are you? What is your climate? What are you growing? More importantly, what kind of rotation are you in? What is your tillage management? How are you managing those residues now? What is your nutrient management? Do you have an animal system where you're bringing in processed carbon back into that field? It makes a difference, such as manure, or can you grow cover crops, some other things? And what are you going to limit your constraints on? Are you going to, the early estimates on how much residue might be available only considered erosion. They didn't take in soil carbon, and there's been a shift from that to start looking more at carbon, and there may be other constraints. So what is that? Looking at carbon, you have the change in carbon over time. So you have the rate of humification, the process of converting materials into carbon, and then you have mineralization, the decomposition. And this particular slide or equation doesn't really address erosion per se. Erosion is kind of assumed at this case that it's that held neutral. But when there is no change in carbon, then the change in carbon over time is zero. So at that point, if these two coefficients are stable, then A, which is the annual inputs, becomes proportional to carbon at equilibrium. It's not necessarily one-to-one, but it's proportional. And that's the type of philosophy or approach that was used by Bill Larson back in the late 70s, and just have extrapolated that to give some empirical estimates on what you need for soil organic matter. Pulled this out, these are all for the United States, and this is the number of studies that were included in there out of the literature, and summarized this recently in a review article, in a book. And from the Midwest, there's a fair number of studies, mostly with corn and or soybeans, a few out of the Great Plains, but you can see that different areas have different numbers of studies that we can fall back on, and that there's a fair bit of variability within these numbers. So you can crunch it down into one nice number, but the trouble is that the standard error is nearly as large as the mean, so I could predict how much biomass needs to be returned on average and be right on average and wrong almost everywhere. Therein lies the problem. But it does allow you to start having discussions and looking at some different types of scenarios and thinking about things. And one of the studies that came out, and a problem that when I first got into this, is like, well, if I'm managing for erosion, what does that do for soil carbon? And there really was not an easy way to adjust that until a few years ago. And then doing some modeling, the models in behind here for water and wind erosion are the Russell 2 for water, and then the WEPs behind here for the soil erosion. And this is in part of eastern Nebraska and part of in Iowa where they put these two. And the take-home message here is that there are cases, at least, that the amount of material you need to return to the land to protect for soil organic carbon can be dramatically higher. And the worst case scenario here, or most dramatic, is that if you're only controlling for water or wind erosion, you are way overestimating how much you can take off for soil carbon. Even in a case where you have to leave a lot, there's still a discrepancy. So therein lies an issue. Of course, the basic premise on this, and I'll get to it again later, is that if you're in highly erodible lands, you got no business taking any residue off. So these are situations where the erosion risks are less, moderately. So this is a paper I put together with Doug Carlin and Susan Andrews this summer. And we started looking at, well, if we're going to do this, what are the things we have to make sure we're paying attention to? First off, let's take care of the erosion. One of the reasons we start there is that the models are available. The conservation practices are available. We've studied this and figured out how to do this over a long time. So we know that we need to maintain sufficient cover. You know that if we reduce the amount of tillage that's being done, that can help reduce erosion. And if you're going to start harvesting, you need to get out there and make sure you're watching. Just because you've gone to no-till, if you've harvested too much residue, you will still have erosion. It's not that you've stopped doing tillage that protects the soil. The reason no-till protected the soil is it left the residue on the soil. So therein is something you need to be cautious about. Soil fertility, soil organic matter, and other properties as well. So the nice thing is that some of the management things reinforce each other. That if you are in soil organic matter and you reduce tillage, you're protecting both for erosion and organic matter. So those are important things. One of the strategies you can use is let's limit the harvest. So there's some studies that are going on that looking at, this would be a very intensely harvested area. There's not a whole lot of residue left behind. And by the time the winds come through and we get to spring, this is going to be a pretty bare field, even though there's no tillage. And you can see how the combine is coming through, and it is running it as close to the ground as possible. Doing a one-pass harvest, the stover is getting blowed back here, the grain's going up on top. And here you can see where the stover is really quite high, where we've gone through and done a reasonably high cut. So let's see what happens, you know, can we do this? Chances are, this is a no-till farmer, so he will not till this down, we'll keep the stover on top, so I'm pretty sure we'll be able to manage for the erosion here. It's a pretty flat, open field. He's got windbreaks. And then on this different field, same farmer, they're going through and they're doing a one pass. Everything's being left behind except grain and the cobs. And then, of course, then the other strategy is you just harvest the grain and everything gets left behind. So part of this is what is the appropriate rate? And in many cases, the answer there is none. You may have none of my stover. In other cases, maybe you can have the cobs. And if you have really, really high yields and you have very low erosion rate, maybe you can take what's above the ear. So the harvest rate. As you increase disturbance, as you increase tillage, as you increase various disturbance, you have to reduce the amount of harvest. If you are in a situation where your yields are low or in part of your crop rotation you have very low residue producing crops with low carbon to nitrogen ratios, then I'd suggest that you need to reduce that again because now you have to leave more of your high residue producing crop on the field in order for this to work. You know, that might be maybe you're in a wheat fallow system. Well, if you're in a wheat fallow, during the year you have residue, you have to leave everything on there to make sure that you have enough to cover when it's not there. Where are you at? As the region becomes warmer and wetter, decomposition is faster, you're going to need to have more inputs. As your slope increases, you're going to have to leave more on for erosion control. As you get into sandier soils, these are all factors that need to be considered. Can you use cover crops? There may be some situations where, because you've harvested some materials, you've harvested the corn stover or the wheat straw, and you have an opportunity to come in with cover crops to provide an additional carbon input and additional protection against erosion. So now you've done another mitigating strategy that might make it work. Here's an example in a forested area where there's a very nice layer of cover crop to protect that land. This is one of my fields where we've got a hairy vetch and then following the wheat is allowed to grow up, and we won't do anything with it until spring, then we'll spray it down if we need to and kill the vetch because that's pretty resilient, and then we'll come in and with our following crop, which I believe is soybeans in this system. We've got some rye coming underneath our corn here, and there's some baling of some other crops, so a perennial coming in and managing with a modified harvest there as well. So other conservation tillages, whether it's conservation tillage or complete no-till, but making sure that that land is covered. And here's a situation where it's conservation tillage, but there's not much residue left on there. Here's the instrument that went through doing kind of a strip till. And very nice cover here in this particular plot where we've been in no-till for some time. So there's some other interesting strategies. When are you going to harvest your perennial? And is that in a dedicated field, or are you doing some other kind of management? A really kind of unique thing that my colleague Russ Gesch has been working on, here's one of his oilseed crops that's coming up. It's soybeans growing underneath here. So what he's doing is doing a relay system. And if you have adequate moisture, this can work. The pennycress, I think, might be one of the, I'm not quite sure if this is camelina or if it's pennycress, but one of his early season crops where he was able to plant that early, actually it's planted in the winter, it comes up and the soybeans are planted in there. You harvest it off early enough that you get a soybean crop. And granted, he took a yield hit in the soybeans, but when he put it on an oil basis, he actually got substantially more oil harvest in the relay crop than with just soybeans because of this high yield of the oil, even though in this particular system. So other ways of increasing the intensity on that land. So in 3 years, he gets, or in 2 years, he gets three crops instead of two. And in some ways, looking at harvesting corn grain and corn cobs is another way of getting an additional crop off that same unit of land, which may help this avoid going into land use because you're making more higher intensity use of the land that's available. And then, of course, there's always these wonderful byproducts that in a farm area that you can take advantage of that bring in carbon and nutrients and cycle them back to the landscape. Other managements that have to be in place. If we're going to harvest any residue from some places, you have to make sure that you're managing things and using all the conservation practices available. We do not want to degrade the land. Maybe that's the grassy waterways. Maybe it's stripping, windbreaks, all these other types of managements. And where on that landscape can you or should you harvest? There is no place that I can think of where you could indiscriminately go in routinely and harvest year after year after year after year. We're not going to have a silver bullet coming out of crop rag residues. The numbers don't compute. But it might provide, in localized areas, a silver bullet. And so what are some guidelines? How are we going to do it? Well, first off, you're in highly erodible lands. Leave them alone. Take care of them. Don't go out there trying to get more out of them. There are no free lunches in the environment. So those are off the board. You need to be putting in every conservation practice that is at your disposal to protect them. Then you have these lands that are eligible for conservation programs. And in most cases, they need to be excluded as well. unless you're growing perennials, and then there's a lot of debate on how much and how often and how those can be managed. That's a whole area of new research that needs to be conducted. If you're on lands, ag lands that are in moderate erosion risk, then it's debatable if you have to manage by erosion risk or soil organic matter. And if you're doing it, you need to be having, what is your compensating strategy? What else are you going to do to make it work? Ag lands with low erosion risk. Now we run into having to make sure that we're managing for organic matter, because if you're managing for erosion, you will overestimate how much you need that you can harvest and not be returning anywhere near enough to maintain your soil organic matter. And again, there's these perennials. I'd say there's very little research that I'm aware of that's really addressed this as clearly as it needs to be. So kind of wrapping up, what the risk is going to depend on what is your feedstock. Are you looking at corn on corn in a highly intensively tilled area that has yields that are barely maintaining organic matter now, or are you in incredibly high yielding systems where you have an opportunity to come in with other mitigating factors? What is your soil type? What is your other management strategies? What are the environmental constraints that you have, or what are the environmental services that you want to make sure that you protect? What are you willing to sacrifice? Are you willing to sacrifice some environmental services in order to get your energy? And you can go on and on and on, and making sure that we're using conservation management. This is my small print acknowledgments, ARS and various, I have two different grants that have helped funded this. And Rattan had made some really nice points about where policy needed to go and where we need to be thinking at. And I just want to really reinforce that if we don't change our energy consumption and energy use patterns, we're never going to get to the goal that we need, and we need to take personal responsibility on how we might make that happen. Thank you, and I don't know if I have time for questions or not. So.